Good evening, and welcome to the first season and the first episode of Deep Dive with Dr. Tracy. I'm your host, Dr. Tracy Pearson. First, I want to start out by telling you a little bit about myself. I was a practicing lawyer for about 2 decades, and I represented a varied array of clients and businesses. I was a mediator and an investigator, and I have investigated just about anything that you can imagine an independent investigator would investigate. I moved to California to take a job, and that experience led me to wanting to learn more about how organizations work to understand why there were so many problems and how I could help fix them. I went back to school and I earned a second doctorate because, well, one wasn't enough. And by the time writing my dissertation arrived, I had narrowed my focus in problem solving down to implicit bias and its impact on investigations. I started talking about my work, and that landed me a guest opportunity on the Power Hour talk panel here on ENSL TV. Ultimately, I was offered an opportunity to develop a show. So here I am in Los Angeles, California, hosting a television show that is being broadcast across the world. So that's happening. Now, as a little kid, it was never my dream to be on TV. I never thought that that would be an opportunity for me. And we'll get to that later on in some later episodes. But here I am, and I am really glad to be here. I really am. And I'm really glad that you're here too. I said I never wanted to be on TV when I was little. When I played pretend, when I was a little kid, I pretended that I was the teacher. And ultimately, when I got a little bit older, I did quite a bit of that in a lot of different places. So with that in mind, the idea behind this show came from watching a lot of news. I mean, a lot of news. Besides yelling at the TV, and no, the TV didn't yell back, so I'm okay there. What I noticed was that I see the same people night after night. They talk about the same issues night after night, but our country doesn't seem to be moving from its entrenched positions. If anything, these positions are worse than they've ever been. Now, I'm a problem solver. Some say it's both my gift and my curse. And I like to think about possible causes for problems because if you don't know the cause, you aren't going to solve the problem. For example, if you work, and I want you to raise your hand at home, how many times has your boss or the company mucked with things to solve a problem that didn't exist? And that made a real problem worse, or it created a problem that didn't exist before? That was a lack of understanding the problem. It seems to me, based on just some casual observation, that it's possible that we have a knowledge problem. Fundamental to learning is being uncomfortable. So I'm going to give you an example of what I mean when I say a knowledge problem. I recognize that among the viewers out there, I may anger you with this, but it's real and it's close to my heart. Let me give you this example. If you actually knew what the Constitution of the United States said, would you break into the United States Capitol building thinking that you or anyone you were with were going to keep President Biden from taking office? That, among other things, is a knowledge problem. Now, I know the social studies teachers around the country are saying amen to that. So with that in mind, what we're gonna do here is we're going to approach these issues and these problems with the same people talking the same things every night and dealing with this knowledge problem. What we're going to do is we're going to approach it from the perspective of what I call the knowledge meter. What I want to do is make that knowledge meter moving in the direction of more, not less, not the same, but more. People tune it out and they listen to whatever they want to hear, which is just reinforcement of what they already know. And if what you already know is wrong or incorrect or just off, then it isn't doing anything for you. It isn't changing the circumstances and it isn't helping anybody learn anything new. It's just making people feel more comfortable. So what I want to do with this show is I want to make sure that we are bringing new voices to the channel, and we are bringing people that you haven't heard from before, to be able to bring different perspectives to the issues that are really important to you. And so tonight, we have a number of guests. We have two guests that are incredible, and they are going to be talking to us about their lived experiences and from their perspectives. As I was developing this first episode, I was surprised by things that they told me. Now, plain and simple, I'm not out here to be proselytizing, which some might disagree with. But look, I am the host, and I get to sit in this great big chair, and I get to put my spin on things at the beginning and at the end. But you folks at the other end of this camera, you play an important part too. During the show, we have a producer, and tonight it's our executive producer, Mel Andre, who's monitoring comment sections. And she's going to toss us some questions that you have. If, in fact, you have some questions, you can post them wherever you are. If you're on Twitter, if you're on Facebook, wherever you are, you can post your questions and we'll know. And they'll toss them to us and we'll see if we can get our guests to give you some great answers. And I may pick and choose from those questions. So this show isn't about a one-sided presentation. I know that you're out there, and I want to hear from you. Even after this show, I want to hear from you. And you can tweet me at Tracy Explains or at Deep Dive TV, either one. But by providing a space for different voices, mine, our guests, yours, I hope that we're going to increase understanding, that maybe there might be some learning that happens. As I said, I've taught in formal settings and as a lawyer and a mediator and an investigator. And in those roles, I had a teaching function too. I had to teach the judge the law. I had to teach the jury the law. I had to teach people that I was investigating about the process. So what I'm really good at is talking about complex things and explaining them in a way so that others understand it. I have appeared on a number of podcasts where I have changed people's perspectives. I'm talking the host. And I've talked to reporters where I did the same thing. Now, does that mean that I'm going to change your perspective or your position? No, that's a motivation problem. But if you're watching this show, then you're motivated to listen. And that's a great place to start. So let's get started. Say their names. Rika Boyd. Eric Garner. Tamir Rice. Freddie Gray, Trayvon Martin, George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, Ryan Whitaker, Tony Timpa, Daniel Shaver, Ayanna Jones, Adam Toledo. I can't say all their names, and I'm sorry. I can't say all their names for this year alone. According to the Washington Post, as of airtime, 925 people have been shot and killed by the police in the last year. The Washington Post has been tracking these incidents since 2015, and you can find that data on their website or by Googling Washington Post and police shootings. Now, the average number of people killed by police each year is about 1,000, and we still have the rest of December to go. And I'm having technical difficulties. And it's incredibly difficult. And some thought it was probably impossible to hold a law enforcement officer accountable. And there really, you know, is no one definitive explanation for that. A lot of people have a lot of theories, but the fact of the matter is that there is no one explanation for that. Our lives are not sitcoms. They aren't House MD. And at the end of the day, we are faced with the reality that the police have this incredible, awesome power. When I became an attorney, I used to think that I had a lot of power. And I did, and well, I still like to think I do. I can produce your body somewhere to answer questions. I can take away the things that are important to you. I can take away your house. I can take away your car. I can take away your retirement account. I can take away your child. But I can only do that with a court. Law enforcement officers can do it with a gun. They can take your life. And they don't need a court to do it. In this country, it is lawful for a law enforcement officer to use deadly force in circumstances where there is a threat of imminent danger to their life or someone else's life. There is also an exception for if an officer has been threatened and the suspect is dangerous and the suspect is fleeing, that it's okay for an officer to use deadly force. When it is not okay is when the suspect is unarmed and not a threat. So we've had in this country a number of shootings where that has been a dispute. And these are situations that are very difficult for people to understand. I'm not a law enforcement officer. I have never fired a gun. I have no interest in doing that. Some people do. And my feelings about that are that when you take a human life, it is a life-altering event. And that's not something that I take lightly. It is a life-altering event for the officer, obviously for the family, who has to deal with the consequences of that, and for society in general. And you know, I don't know what the how an officer does that. And tonight we're going to talk with a couple of law enforcement officers, both former law enforcement officers, one who was a federal DEA agent. But I don't know how to do that. I don't know how I would feel after that. And we often hear that officers are dealing with adrenaline, and you know, these are errors. However, in these circumstances, you know, my body's like their body's like your body. We have what's called an autonomic nervous system, and it's broken down into two parts. There's a parasympathetic and a sympathetic nervous system. And the sympathetic nervous system is what controls stress response. It's what decides whether you're going to have a flight, fight, or freeze response. And so I have no idea if I were faced with a situation where my life were actually threatened, whether I would be able to fire that gun. I hope I never get there. But police officers, they deal with that every day. When they go out into the field, they don't know who they're dealing with. Or if they do know who they're dealing with, they have an understanding of the range of risks, but they can't know everything because people aren't predictable. If they were, then we wouldn't have these problems, right? They could just predict it and everything would be fine. So under these circumstances, I don't know how I would react to it. And so we're going to hear tonight about some experiences that folks have had so that we can understand a little bit better about this issue and try to understand each other a little bit better. You know, this show is not about debating. We do that on another show on this network. And we have a great time doing it. And we're all respectful towards each other. But this show is a little different. This show is about me extracting information from people who are professionals, who are experts, and bringing them to you because other networks aren't. And for you to maybe get some more information and to consider that information and think a little bit differently. So tonight we have two guests. Our first guest is a gentleman by the name of, his name is Larry, and he is our DEA agent. He is a former Maryland state trooper who is was on the tactical team, and he then became a DEA agent and worked for a little over two decades, as an officer. And he's had a wide range of experiences, and he has a wide range of thoughts about these things. So I am very happy to welcome to the show our guest for this evening from the federal side of things, Larry. So Larry, why don't you tell folks a little bit about yourself and your experience?
Well, first of all, Dr. Tracy, thank you for having me on your show. I appreciate being here, and hopefully I'll be able to maybe give some insight or educate some information that maybe people just don't know about. Having spent almost about 30 years in law enforcement, you know, I worked just about every level. I worked from the local level to the state level, and obviously with the federal government. So each entity has different responsibilities in what we perform in law enforcement. And so I gained a lot of knowledge, experience, expertise, whatever you want to call it. But it deals with real life situations and real experiences.
Why did you decide to become a police officer?
You know, that's always a good question. It's kind of funny because I think a lot of us that go in law enforcement or maybe just like the military, it's almost like a calling that it's something that you really want to do. And I remember a little funny story that my one neighborhood friend always tells me about. He always had to be the bad guy and I always had to be the good guy. And I get to put the plastic handcuffs on. And we still talk about this today. And we're in our mid 60s talking about what happened almost decades ago. So it was just something that the attraction was there. I went to college for it. Got my bachelor's degree in law enforcement administration. I had a minor in sociology because I thought those two meshed. One hand washes the other, so to speak, because one hand you're learning the law, criminal procedures, et cetera. And the other hand, you're learning more about people. And so it gives you, a well-rounded education in dealing with folks that you're going to deal with in your career. And that's that was one of the reasons why I picked sociology as my minor. And I thought it was a great start to combine the two.
Now, you worked as a Maryland state trooper and then moved over to being a DEA special agent. Why did you do that?
Well, I started, I worked in uniform for about 3 years with Maryland State Police. Did, handle all the major incidents. I got recruited to go work in narcotics. And so I started working undercover. I really liked the challenge. And you learn about the legal system, when you start working drug cases because they involve search warrants and, you get some of the best criminal defense minds, lawyers that, that come at you at every angle. And I just thought it was a great challenge. And, you write affidavits. You do wiretaps, listen, this is all obviously court approved. Those are the things that you learn about the law. And just like lawyers, they find a lot of different niches and it becomes interesting to them. And so my niche was working drug law enforcement. I thought it was a big challenge. It still is by today's world. We're seeing more overdose deaths than ever before. And, we have fentanyl poisoning our kids. They're dying, You know, we lost 100,000 people this year. So I thought that that was part of what I wanted to do, was really save people their lives, basically, because we have, in my view, one of the biggest challenges that faces this country and the world. And it's the poison that's being put out on our streets.
What's the biggest difference that you noticed between working as a state law enforcement officer and a federal law enforcement officer?
Well, you know, the training was a little different. The Maryland State Police was more like a paramilitary type organization. And DEA is more like a domestic international type law enforcement agency. So, and there's, you know, they, you know, when you work on a state police, you do obviously things differently than you would do as a DEA agent. The training, I can tell you, on both ends were exceptional. I learned a lot starting with the Maryland State Police. I've had some great training there. And I think one up came when I came to work for the government, knowing that the government really is on top of the training world, because, you know, you do a certain thing like drug investigations, you have to be on top of your game every second, every minute, every hour. And so training was very, very important. And learning how to deal with situations, you know, not every time that, you know, you have to look at different situations. You can't just sometimes over a trailer, just go break a door down in a house. You don't know what's behind that. You have to evaluate what's inside of that house. So, you know, we do a, what we call operational plans. They're very thorough. They're very well thought out of, you know, we may, if let's say, for example, we're going to do a search warrant on a residence. We may have agents outside doing surveillances on a particular location. We may want to see who's coming and going. We might, you know, that sometimes will tell you and what you might be dealing with. You know, a lot of times you look at, well, hey, are there kids in this house? You know, this always comes to mind. You know, we don't, we try to take a safe approach as best as we can, because at the end of the day, we don't want anybody to get hurt. And it's not worth somebody losing their life over this. It really isn't. And, you know, there's a lot of high demand, stress, et cetera, that goes with the territory. And if you don't have a good family foundation, you know, that's all part of it too.
Do you think that the police always follow protocols?
No, I do not.
Do you have an example of a time where you witnessed a failure to follow a protocol that may have created a dangerous circumstance?
Well, I think if you're referring to something that I think that you and I had talked about before, there was a situation when we were going to execute a search warrant, and we collectively trained what we call a high, you know, most search warrants are high risk search warrants, drug warrants, let's say. So we train what we call the dynamic entry. We call it a snake entry, where there's six agents, you know, lined up behind each other. One has the responsibility of a shield. Another one has the responsibility of the battering ram. And we go in and we go room to room. Of course, you know, we're yelling and identifying ourselves and who we are and so on. In this particular situation that I was in, the two people who were responsible for bringing the proper equipment failed to do that. And I'm a very, when I look at doing things, I want to do them very methodically, and I want to make sure that we're doing it the right way. No shortcuts. Shortcuts get people hurt on either side of the fence. So, I looked at this and, you know, and I asked the, one of the agents that was their investigation. I said, well, who has the shield? Okay, because that shield really is your cover for going into somebody's residence. And obviously, you don't know what's on the other side of that door. And I can tell you, as many drug warrants that I've been involved with, there hasn't been too many residents that I haven't been in that didn't have weapons. And I mean, plenty of weapons. So what happened was, we did the search warrant. We did our, in the federal government, we do more knock and announce warrants. Knocked on a door, yelled police, etc. So the person that hit the door shouldn't have been hitting the door. He should have been he should have been the number three person where I was. So to make a long story short, I end up going through the door first. We had no shield. And as soon as we entered the door, just on the other side of that door, less than 10 feet, was an individual with a sawed-off shotgun who just nodded off. And all he had to do was turn and fire. And sometimes, you know, you begin to think that somebody's looking out for you when that happened. And so my training taught me how to respond to that. I could have shot that person justifiably, but we had the upper hand. There was no need for me to discharge my weapon, even though there was potential for violence there. So, and that was, you know, a lesson learned. We, unfortunately, in law enforcement, we live and die by our own mistakes. And that happens on a regular basis, even by today's standards, you know. So the other person that we were looking for was not there. Come to find out, they had been in a shootout with some other drug traffickers in New York over heroin. They were guarding the door thinking these guys were coming back to kill them. You know, so there was, you know, there was weapons in the house. Fortunately, there was no children in there. The person that we were looking for, we ended up arresting him outside of his residence. You know, he went and put his hands up. We ordered him to, and eventually removed a weapon underneath his armpit. So you look at your training, you look at your responsibility. I can tell you that this bothered me. I went and sat down, you know, after the adrenaline that you were referring to in your opening remarks, you know, I had time to sit back and think what just could have happened within seconds. And, you know, I went through this cold sweat. I mean, I was literally, my clothes were literally drenched because I know in seconds that I could have been dead.
I want to turn your attention to a very public case. It's the case of Derek Chauvin. Who was convicted of murdering George Floyd.
Right.
What went wrong based on, you know, again, you don't have inside information. You have as much information as mm-hmm. is publicly available. But what went wrong within law enforcement with that? How did that happen?
Well, I mean, you had a bad cop. You know, there's no room for them. We all know that. I mean, you know, what we saw horrified me. Is it horrified all the citizens in this country? You know, putting his knee on the man's neck, you know, and just doing things that he should have never done. And there was, you know, there were some issues with the officer that he had many complaints against him. So he wasn't one of the role models that I would have put on a street and working with some young officers who happened to you know, be involved in that response. And when you look at George Floyd's behavior, you look at more like someone has some medical issue. You know, he did take the fentanyl, but you know, these are things when this is all your training, you're evaluating when you're talking to somebody, and his behavior is not normal. So you ask the guy, hey, are you okay? What's up? What's going on here? You know, is there a problem? I don't, you know. So if you start evaluating and talking to people and seeing what their issue is, you know, maybe he would have said, hey, listen, I'm sick. You know, I need an ambulance or something. Or the police may have looked at this guy and say, this guy needs help. He needs an ambulance. We should get him out of there. You know, hey, did you take something? Did you swallow something? You know, what's the deal here? We can't help you if you don't tell us. So when I look at that scene that happened, I mean, it was just, it was mind boggling.
Well, let me ask you a question. What can we do to get, you know, I'm going to use your terminology, bad cops off the force before they kill someone else?
Yeah. Well, I have one word, and that's called fire them. Two words, I should say, fire them. If they're not meeting the standards. Now, you know, obviously, there's union representations. There's some legal issues with, you know, within the law enforcement organizations, and some rightfully so. But when you have to discipline somebody, and this guy has 18, 20 complaints, what do you do with them? You don't put them on a street. So you either take them off the street and put them in some cushy job, or have them write parking tickets or something. Not even that. Just put them in an office somewhere and stick them in a corner, or you fire them. That's it. There's no other avenue. And I know that the majority of our law enforcement are good people. There are bad apples. We have to weed them out, and they have to be dealt with, whatever the violation of the law is. I put bad cops in federal prison for selling drugs or being involved in drug trafficking. So I don't have any issues with that. If they break the law or they're not doing their job, then there's accountability. And we should always have our law enforcement people accountable, because they're accountable to the community. They're accountable to, you know, who they represent, the organization that they represent. So every organization, no matter what it is, have bad apples, have issues.
Because they're human beings. Go ahead.
Yeah, because they're human beings. So, you know, you have bad doctors, good doctors, bad lawyers, good lawyers. You know, it's just a fact of life. And the only problem is you have to really screen law enforcement people, because they do have the power that you were talking about in your monologue. You have to make sure that you get the very best that you can get. But the problem is, you know, there's, you know, if you join law enforcement to be financially stable, or think you're going to buy some big boat, you might want to find something else to do. But
I thought the same thing as a lawyer. Yeah. You know, you think you're going to make a lot of money as an attorney. I don't think so. I do have a question that's come in from Wade Saxton, who I'm going to recognize here. He's a friend of the network. He's on the Power Hour talk panel, and he has a question for you, which is, more importantly, how do you empower fellow law enforcement officers to take action against bad cops in the moment to stop them without retaliation?
That's a very good question, Wade. You know, there used to be a thing called the Blue Code of Silence, but that had bred corruption in some of our largest police departments, where, hey, you don't tell on what this guy did. But I can tell you, a lot of that has changed. That mindset has changed. You have to understand that if you're dealing and this person is a bad cop, you've got to take, as a good cop, appropriate measures and steps. What does that mean? That means is you go to your supervisor and you explain to them what's going on. You go to them and say, hey, look, this guy has done this, this, and this. You know, if I saw somebody taking money in front of me, they're going to get arrested. I don't care who they are. If we're in a house and somebody's stealing money and I saw them, they're going to get confronted right off the bat.
But, and that sounds great. But when you have somebody like Derek Chauvin, who has three right. officers that are under his, right. his care, and they're right. standing there watching him murder someone.
Yeah.
What do you do?
Well, here's the problem in one sense. You have these young guys that are standing there with this person, I'll call them, and looking around on what to do. Now, I can understand they're new and maybe they're a little shy or don't want to say anything or don't want to say anything to this guy, or maybe there's going to be problems. But at the end of the day, I don't care if you got 1 week on a job, 2 weeks, 10 weeks, or 20 years, you cannot let something like that happen. That has to be stopped right in its tracks. You have to do something. And there's mixed views on that. These young guys are put in a bad position with this bad cop, so to speak. But my thing is, first of all, they should have never been put in that position with him in the first place. That's a management issue with the police department. Everybody has responsibilities. And so management has the responsibility to make sure that people like this don't get out on the street or they go get them to do something else. And you certainly don't put young officers who are being trained by this guy. What kind of example is he? He's not an example. He's not a good example. I've been trained by some of the best when I was with the Maryland State Police. Decent people did the job. They told me the things that you should do and shouldn't do, and things that you learn. It's the same principle. You can't put good people with a bad person.
I have one last question before I let you go, with the promise that you'll come back again, because I think that a lot of people have questions for you,
Sure.
and we're
I would love
limited on
to.
time. Is
I would love to.
hypoth Thank you. Hypothetically, if you were in those rookie officer positions, how would you have stopped what was happening to George Floyd?
I would have, well, I looked at that and I would have just grabbed them and pulled them off. I just walked up to them and snatched them. If I saw what they saw, I'm not gonna, there's not gonna be a debate. I'm grabbing him. And guess what? If he wanted to complain to the sergeant, okay, you're telling the sergeant, you're stopping this idiot from doing something stupid. And he's gonna, he's looking like to me that he's killing this person. And you got to take action. I mean, you have a responsibility to protect citizens as well. That's your job, okay? So if we're looking at this at the big picture, we can't tolerate this kind of behavior. There's no room for it. Absolutely none. Zero tolerance is my motto with that kind of behavior by people who take an oath to uphold the law, the Constitution of this country. You don't, you're not, the executioner. You're not the judge or the jury. We have our system in place. That's why we have judges. That's why we have lawyers. That's why we have a system. And if you do those types of measures and take that type of responsibility upon yourself, that you're the judge, jury, and executioner, then you don't belong there. You belong in a jail cell.
Thank you, Larry Ferletta. It was a pleasure having you on, and you have the honor of being the first guest ever on Deep Dive with Dr. Tracy. So congratulations for that.
Thank you.
And we hope that you will come back again because I think that our viewers have lots of questions for you.
I appreciate it. And it was great to be with you. Thank you.
Thank you. Our second guest is a former California Senate Sergeant at Arms. And now, attorney Ryan Harrison Sr. Ryan has testified in front of the California Assembly on a bill that prohibits asphyxiation techniques and another bill prohibiting chokeholds. He also testified about the history of police reform in America on behalf of the California Black Lawyers Association. Ryan, welcome to the Deep Dive with Dr. Tracy. Now, you have the honor of being the last guest on the first episode. So, congratulations. You notice how I didn't say second. I said last
Thank you,
guest.
Dr. Thank you.
It's great to have you here. So now you were a former law enforcement officer who testified in front of the California Assembly on behalf of the California Black Lawyers Association regarding bills limiting the use of force. And you became a lawyer who does defense side labor and employment law work. Can you unpack that for me?
Yes. So I often go in and mentor high school students and tell them about success in life. And in the short story, it's just not a straight line, right? And I'll try to, you know, package this in the briefest form possible. But, you know, I grew up in a very tough neighborhood in North Vallejo, California. Got a football scholarship to Davis, where I played ball, graduated. And my first job was at a Target store as the executive team lead of their assets protection department. I was placed in that role. It was just a good job out of college. And it was basically a quasi law enforcement role. And I was very good at it. I was noticed by a pharmacist in the store. She told me to go talk to her friend who happened to be the deputy chief sergeant at arms in the California State Senate, which is essentially a dignitary protection role in law enforcement. I interviewed for the job. I got it. And there I was just inspired being in the people's building, the legislature, and seeing how the will of the people and the needs of the people translated into law that were then enforced by people like me, law enforcement officers. And it was the pro tem of the Senate, who's the most powerful senator, who I used to protect. I was his bodyguard. He and I spoke about policy and things like that. And I got curious and got a master's degree in criminal justice. And we further engaged in these discussions. And after a couple of years, he said, "Ryan, you need to go to law school. You can do a lot to help people in need." And I took him up on that and I tried it. It was difficult, but I made it work. And now I'm an attorney. And that's kind of how it worked. And being a student in law school, you have various summer jobs. I worked at a firm. My first firm job during my 1L summer in law school was for a big firm in San Francisco. And they had a section that focused on labor and employment defense. And the partner there kind of took me under his wing, mentored me. And that's how I became a labor and employment defense attorney.
Okay. Well, when you testified in front of the California Assembly about police reform in America, you mentioned in your testimony Sir Robert Peel's. Can you tell our viewers just a little bit briefly about who this person is?
Yes. So Sir Robert Peel had this vision of policing. And to some degree, it was flawed. But I think the nine principles of policing he highlighted were critical, and in particular, two of them. That I think if we really kind of bring those principles to life, which in my opinion, in this country, we have never done so. But if we did, we would see a very different police force. And those principles, you can Google, just Google Sir Robert Peel's nine principles of policing. But focus here on principle number five, where in the short kind of abbreviated statement of what that means is that, you know, law enforcement officers need to demonstrate impartial service to the law and disregard the political situation of the community or of the world, disregard the wealth of the person they're engaging, and just offer to them the service that the legislature has bestowed upon them to really, at its core, effectuate life and vitality for the people. Their job is to enforce the law, but they enforce the laws passed by the people that facilitate their livelihood. And so they really need to kind of embody that, because they are the literal embodiment of the government, right? And the second principle is principle number eight. And this one is really important. And this one really goes to use of force and police brutality. And this one really talks about how, you know, law enforcement officers should not even seem to usurp the power of the judiciary in avenging individuals or the state, or of authoritatively judging guilt or punishing the guilty. In our democracy, judging guilt and punishing the guilty is reserved for our judiciary. And when people believe that if an officer is coming to get them and the officer is going to also be the judgment upon them, they're not gonna freely allow that officer to arrest them. They're not gonna comply. There's going to be a gunfight. And in a similar vein, if people have an issue, let's say I have an issue with you, I could turn to the judicial system to help us hash this problem out, and we can effectuate justice by using our judicial system. If I believe that our judicial system and the officers who enforce these laws are not going to give me real justice, then, you know, I'm going to come after you personally and be the vigilante and effectuate my own justice. And that's when you start to see issues like, you know, crime in the community, violent crime. That's people taking justice into their own hands and enforcing their own rules in society.
Now, I'm going to ask you a controversial question, because that's what we do here. But around the time that Peel's principles came out, there was a stark contrast in how white people and Black people were treated in this country. On one hand, Peel's lays out this concept of these basic principles having to do with essentially, we don't catch criminals, we want to prevent crime. And at the same time, the Barbados slave codes of 1661 were alive and well, and they had authorized all manner of violence that could be used against Black slaves if they tried to escape. So there was one set of rules that protected white people, and then a different set of rules that promised violence against Black people. And my question to you is our system of policing founded on racism?
The answer is that it's a little more difficult than that. And I mean, the easiest answer is yes. You know, we had the slave patrols in the South, and we hear that a lot. But really, what we see in the beginning of American policing is that the police really protected the rights of the political and economic elite. And in the South, those were the plantation owners. And they pretty much sent the police out to protect their property. In the North, these were the factory owners and the business owners, and the police were the primary force to quell riots and strikes by the workers who wanted to earn higher wages. And so that's kind of the situation with the original arm of policing we experienced in America, is that they weren't there to effectuate justice. They weren't there to be the literal embodiment of democracy. They were there to essentially be henchmen for the rich and the powerful. And in the 1980s, we start to see this professionalization of policing, where they started to improve, and we saw improvement, but we're not there yet.
I want to ask you a question, because I saw a comment that Wade Saxton made in the chat, and I've got a question that goes to this. So are you familiar with the case of Daniel Shaver?
I'm not.
Okay. No. He was a 40-year-old white man who was shot to death with an AK-15 rifle five times, killed instantly. He was at a hotel, there was an incident that occurred where he had a pellet gun, and somebody saw it point out the window, and he was talking to his friends. He wasn't attempting to do anything, but someone called the police. The police come. They come to the hotel. And they extract one guy from the room without incident. And so Mr. Shaver, this is what happens to him. He is lying prone on the floor of a hotel, and he's told to cross his legs. The police ordered Shaver to push himself up into a kneeling position. While complying with the order to kneel, he uncrossed his legs, and the police shouted that Shaver needed to keep his legs crossed. Startled, he put his hands behind his back and was again warned by police to keep his hands in the air. Still lying prone. Police yelled at Shaver that if he deviated from police instructions again, they would shoot him. Police told him not to put his hands down for any reason. Still lying prone. And he said, "Please don't shoot me." Upon being instructed to crawl, he put his hands down and he crawled on all fours, because he needed to put his hands down to crawl, right? He's got to keep his hands in the air. While crawling towards the officers, he paused and he moved his right hand towards his waistband.
I saw the video.
And for our viewers, I would just want to make sure I threw these facts. Okay. So police officer who later testified, he believed that Shaver was reaching for a weapon, then opened fire with an AR-15, striking Shaver five times and killing him instantly. He was unarmed and may have been attempting to prevent his shorts from slipping down. Was that excessive force?
Yes. Short answer, yes. And there's way more to this situation. The training the commands, the way they engaged him, you know, if you make the wrong move, I'm going to shoot you. I mean, that's not how you de-escalate a situation. Why would the, you know, it's difficult to tell an officer in that situation what you should have done as a Monday morning quarterback, but I would have had him lay prone on the ground, hands out, and you know, and not, instead of threatening him, I would have said, you know, like, I would have been more of a voice of authority saying, look, you know, I want to make sure you get out of this alive, we get out of this alive, do what I tell you to do, and you're going to be fine. That's going to calm him down, help him think rationally, help him follow the commands. And then you can approach him with his hands out in an unthreatening manner and do what you have to do to put him in handcuffs. The fact that he had to crawl backwards, and in my opinion, his shorts did slip down and he went to lift his shorts back up, and it mimicked the motion that a law enforcement officer does and sees kind of when you're at the gun range and you're pulling your arm to practice with the firearm. And, you know, the officers got trigger happy. And that's kind of the issue, right? The officers should have handled the situation much differently to mitigate the chance and the opportunity for deadly force to be used.
I want to turn to a different case. And this one is happening right now. There's a trial in Minnesota where a former police officer shouted taser and grabbed their service weapon and shot a suspect in his car at close range, killing him. What went wrong there to cause that to happen?
So the dominant stream of thought in the law enforcement community, and of which I was a member and know fairly well, is that the officer was just wrapped up in the situation. And although the officer had trained to know that this movement pulls the gun, this movement pulls the taser, reaching across the body, you know, there was a slip of mind because that officer was in a very emotionally charged situation, and it was a mistake. And my response to that is that I know Larry said officers don't get rich, they don't buy a boat on a cop's salary, but in California, at least, and in other places in this country, these cops are the highest paid cops in the world. And they're paid that money for a reason, and they're paid that money not to make those mistakes. And so they need to have that training. They need to be tested so that their minds don't lock up under stressful situations. And if they do lock up and they do make these mistakes and they're not passing these trainings with sufficient marks, then they shouldn't be officers.
What can we do? What can be done to prevent more deaths, unnecessary deaths in these situations? Is there anything that's concrete that can be done?
Yes. So I think the biggest thing that can be done, because, I mean, short story, you know, we're not going to be able to prevent mistakes, legitimate mistakes, from happening, right? I mean, we can try to mitigate that with a training, the right kind of training, evidence-based training. We can do that. But the biggest issue here is this cultural issue that we see in policing, where cops are literally building a culture around criminal behavior. And you know, I don't want to talk bad about cops generally, because most cops are good cops, right? That's the truth. But in my own city of Vallejo, we have cops literally bending their badges in order to show their special membership to this group of cops who have killed people. And once they have their badge bent, and you can Google it, they're protected by this blue shield where cops defend each other and lie for each other. That's come to light. In LA County, the sheriff's department, they have a gang called the Executioners, where the sheriff has been trying to stop this gang and their criminal behavior for years. In fact, he asked our assembly, and I testified on this bill too, to pass a gangs bill that I also testified on, where if two or more officers are engaging in illegal conduct, just being part of that little subgroup of cops can get you fired. And then, you know, look at what just came out in the New York Times yesterday, the Torrance Police Department in Southern California, where 13 officers were implicated in these racial and homophobic text messages where they joked about lynching and killing Black people, gassing Jews, and harming members of the LGBT community. This put 1,400 criminal cases under review and over 100 criminal filings have been dismissed. 35 of them are felony cases, right? And so there's this cultural problem in policing. And the only way to, I guess, address this police use of force issue is to address this cultural issue. And we need to do it with a good set of rules, like this gangs bill that passed the California legislature last session.
Thank you, Ryan. I really appreciate the fact that you came on this show, and I hope that you will agree to come back again.
Oh, yeah. Whenever you need me, I'm here. And I wish I had more time because I could talk about this for hours.
This is one of those things where we need multiple shows, and I think that's something that we'll be thinking about in the future. Yeah. But Ryan Harrison, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks, Dr. Tracy.
Thank you. So 60 minutes goes by really fast. And when I started this show, I told you that the foundation of the idea behind the show was it's based on increasing knowledge and providing an opportunity to listen to different voices, to hear them answer questions, bringing out different perspectives that you might not have heard before. Tonight, we heard from two very accomplished guests who both have experience in law enforcement and both shared perspectives that came from their learned experience. Now, earlier, I talked about how lawyers and police officers were different. Here's how they're the same. No one likes us unless we're needed. No one likes a lawyer and no one likes a cop, but we're both needed in society. You heard from our guests that police officers can do better, that there are problems in law enforcement. Police officers know their system isn't perfect. You heard from a former federal agent that there are bad cops, that there is corruption, that there are people who should never have been selected for the police force to begin with. How police officers are selected for service is an area that needs to be developed. Not everyone can be a police officer. I couldn't be one. Could you? You heard the excuses that are made, and police officers are expect that their fellow officers do their jobs properly. You heard that from them. So if you think that cops don't know that they need to do better, they do. The entire country watched Derek Chauvin murder George Floyd. Three police officers stood by and did nothing. Larry Ferletta is right. Derek Chauvin should never been training cops given what has been reported about his record for use of force and conduct on the job. But those police officers also stood by because of fear. It's the oldest implicit bias that we have. A female paramedic was unable to intervene. She was unable to get their attention. A gathering of people was too, they were too afraid to overtake the officers with guns, and a man died. But Chauvin was forced to account for his behavior, and he was convicted, though he has appealed, and that appeal remains pending. Other police officers have not been held to account. The police officer in the Daniel Shaver case was acquitted by a jury, but some have been fired. When there's no public accounting for misconduct, the public loses faith in our systems of justice, seeing it work for one population and not the other. The difference is infuriating. It's infuriating to me. The fact is that if you kill a police officer in this country, it's a death penalty offense. But if you kill me, it depends, as if my life is worth less, as if your life is worth less. And there is so many places in our systems where privilege creates disparate treatment. And we need to root that out too. As you heard from Ryan, states like California have enacted new laws to try to stop conduct that killed George Floyd and Eric Garner, but they remain dead. And we need to stop waiting for precipitating tragedy before our legislators fix a problem. We need to stop being reactive. You heard about training. Well, as a researcher, I know you can't train away autonomic responses. You can't train away implicit bias. It's always there, and it needs to be mitigated. And as I listened to both guests talk this evening, I lost track of the number of times I counted implicit bias statements, because we all have implicit bias. And every time I see the news about a police shooting, I look at the facts available for the individual cases, the ones that I know, the ones that I can find. Each one is not the same. And I try to think critically about what's transpired. Not every police shooting is justified, and not every police shooting is a good shot. Not every traffic stop a traffic stop is justified, and not every traffic stop is someone just doing their job. Police officers resent the generalizations being made about them, where all cops are bad. And I can understand why. But not all Black and brown people are bad either. Not all Blacks are criminals. Not all Latinos are drug pushers and rapists. Not everyone who is Latino is here unlawfully. And not every white person is a good person either. Some of the most heinous crimes committed have been committed by white people. And we have more people of color incarcerated in prisons in this country when there are white people in affluent neighborhoods, just down the street from me, from where I am, who are snorting cocaine off of their kitchen counters. Race, privilege, and resources all play a part in that disparate treatment. If you listen to older police officers who were on the force prior to 1985, there was a case that the U.S. Supreme Court decided that said that you can't shoot an unarmed fleeing suspect. They will tell you the suspects just need to not run. Just don't run. Just comply. But as in the case of Daniel Schaefer, he was complying impossibly. Last night, I laid down on the floor of my studio here, and I tried to do what Mr. Schaefer was told to do, and I couldn't do it sober. I can't imagine trying to do it intoxicated. Don't resist, don't run, comply. But if a police officer is contending that adrenaline and is subject to the fight, flight, freeze response, isn't a Black teenager who's been sat down for that conversation by his parents and who has learned that he can't trust the police just as susceptible to the way our nervous system operates under stress? Why is he expected to behave differently than a police officer? If we're going to solve the problem of law enforcement use of force in this country and the disproportionate impact that it has on poor non-white populations, then we need to identify what the actual problems are and fix them. Life isn't a TV sitcom, as I said. If you remember House MD, he always wrapped it up in 60 minutes and there was always one solution to that singular problem. That isn't how problems work. There are a host of contributing factors. So when I started this show, I told you that the foundation for it is based on increasing knowledge. Listening to different voices bring different perspective that you may not have heard before. I hope you learned something new. I hope that that needle on the knowledge meter moved a little bit toward more. And I hope we start asking more questions and we start thinking more critically rather than simply taking positions. I hope we try to understand each other. What are we going to do about it if we can't talk with each other about these issues because we aren't willing to listen and to question our own assumptions and beliefs? I want to say thank you again to our guests, Larry Forletta and Ryan Harrison Sr. for their time and contributions. And I want to thank you for joining me this evening on this first show. I didn't tackle an easy topic. I have a knack for challenges. I have a knack for overplanning. But we all made it through. I'm not a puddle on the floor. And neither is my executive producer, as far as I'm aware. I can't see her. But we are going to be back next week on Thursday, 7 p.m. Pacific, 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, where we're going to tackle political influence and cults. I told you I like a challenge. I hope you'll watch and participate. And until we reconvene, be curious. Be safe. Wear a mask. Get vaccinated. Get boosted. And on behalf of all of my colleagues here at ESNL TV, good night.